From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the February 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. The Age of AI. Here at Bletchley Park, one of the birthplaces of modern computing, our latest temporary exhibition, The Age of AI, has just opened. This new gallery explores the power and potential of AI in our everyday lives. From the 1930s origins of what we might now call artificial intelligence to the incredible or alarming potential it might bring, the exhibition explores the benefits and risks of AI in our world today. In this episode, Head of Content Erica Munro meets the team behind the exhibition's creation. Come with us on a gallery tour with Exhibitions and Interpretation Manager Tilly Davies and hear from experts and visitors on their impressions of what AI means to them. There's also a deeper dive into the research and exhibitions case studies with content creator Steve Swaby. Many thanks to our contributors, Dame Wendy Hall, Dr. Ed Pizanap, Professor David Leslie, and the Friends of Bletchley Park exhibition preview visitors.
Listeners may be wondering, why does Bletchley Park have an AI exhibition? What are the connections between artificial intelligence and the World War II site? Tilly, if you're asked that question straight off, what's your first thought? What connects Bletchley Park and artificial intelligence?
So Bletchley Park is quite a unique place to have this exhibition because it's connected both to the history of artificial intelligence and to its more contemporary past as well. Bletchley Park is often thought of as one of the birthplaces of computing and technology. And there were also several codebreakers who worked here who went on to become early pioneers of artificial intelligence. And then more recently, in 2023, Bletchley Park was the venue for the AI Safety Summit hosted by the UK government.
And the exhibition, The Age of AI, which we're going to be talking about, is a legacy funded by the UK government in order to continue those conversations that were started internationally at that global summit, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. So the AI Safety Summit was the first summit in the world that looked at safety specifically within artificial intelligence. And now AI is a leading conversation in a lot of global conferences. And the summit series actually continues with the AI Action Summit taking place in Paris in February.
In just a few days' time as well. AI is on the lips of most people that read any kind of news. I mean, open the BBC News website, watch your evening news, and stories about AI seem to be everywhere. Did you get a sense putting this exhibition together that it was something that everybody had an opinion on?
Definitely. Every day there's a new article about AI and how it's developing and how it's being used in our lives now. So we wanted to explore how it's developing in our everyday lives, what that might look like in the future, and the opportunities and risks that come with that. We really wanted to start a conversation with our visitors and get them to think about how AI can be developed in a safe and sustainable way.
In this episode, we're going to have a bit of behind the scenes magic as Tilly will take us on a tour of the gallery and we'll find out a bit more about what's in the exhibition. And we'll also be hearing from some of the experts that we spoke to in creating the exhibition and from some of the friends of Bletchley Park who got a bit of a sneaky preview of the gallery just a few days ago.
So the sliding doors have opened to the gallery. We've walked in. Tilly, can you tell our listeners what it is that we're looking at here?
So one of the first things you notice as you come into the gallery is the really bold colour scheme. So we've got teal blue walls, we've got these copper coloured steels throughout and painting on the walls as well. First thing that we're looking at right now is our introduction panel, which has the title of the exhibition on it, The Age of AI, and it's surrounded by this data chip motif with lots of lights kind of moving around it. So it's very bright and vibrant, the whole space here.
And that intro panel, part of it as well is transparent. So you can kind of see the gallery moving away behind it. It's a single room. Can you also describe what lies behind what kind of, you've mentioned our teal walls, but is it all text panels? Or?
So we've got lots of things around. We've got lots of things on the walls. Some of them are text panels. We've got lots of images as well and different colours throughout. So our colour palette that we have here is the teal walls, but then we've got oranges and yellows and bright greens as well. And we also have a big structure in the middle of the gallery, which we'll come to later, and some different kind of figures and shapes on the walls too.
I can see some films and I know there's some interactives in there, which we'll get to. I can't wait to get started. Shall we have a bit of a look around?
Let's.
So the exhibition title, The Age of AI, we've got it right in front of us. Why is the exhibition called The Age of AI?
So the title is something that we thought about a lot, and we thought about it internally with our comms team, with our content curator. We also had focus groups and different visitors come up with titles that they might like. And we actually asked different AI models to come up with names for this exhibition. And the one which all of those different groups came up with was The Age of AI. So we thought we had to go with that one.
Absolutely brilliant. If they've all suggested it, then why not? And there were some shocking title potentials, weren't there? I think AI, the past, the present, the future, who knows, or something like that. I'm glad The Age of AI is what we went for. Moving around the room to the first part of the exhibition, I can see definitions on the wall. Can you tell us a bit more?
So the first section of this exhibition is titled What is AI? And we wanted to bring our visitors on a journey and to understand what they think AI is. The definition of AI has changed over time. One of the definitions we have here on the wall is from 1955, the first definition of artificial intelligence. And then we also have more modern ones as well. So we're looking at how people's understandings of artificial intelligence has changed and probably will change as well over the next few years as that field develops, and asking our visitors to think about what artificial intelligence means to them.
I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 definitions that we've offered. We've also said that it can be used to describe technologies and computer science and machine learning. It's quite a broad term that we're using here in the gallery, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Different people, different experts have various definitions of artificial intelligence. We're taking quite a broad look at what that means. We talked to our focus groups again, as well as to experts, to understand what artificial intelligence is. And talking to our focus groups, to teenagers and people their parents' age, we understood what their understanding of artificial intelligence was in order to kind of bring that out in the rest of the exhibition.
I think it's probably important to point out, and regular listeners may be aware, particularly from my perspective, that I am not an AI expert. Are you an AI expert, Tilly?
Absolutely not, no.
But what we do have skills in is presenting stories for our visitors. So hopefully we can show the opinions of experts grouped together in a way that visitors will find interesting, engaging, enlightening, and hopefully they might learn a thing or two about AI on the way.
I'm Charlotte Lane, I'm 15 years old.
Now, Charlotte, you are the perfect age range that this exhibition has been created for. So, can you tell me what you thought of it?
I think it's really information filled because I like to see that there's multiple different topics using and around AI in this exhibition. Because as well as seeing the good aspects, for example, the creativity and the health aspects of it, there's also a lot of things to do with the like really bad kind of aspects of it and how it can be used to harm as well as to help people. I also use it to help me study and for my GCSEs. For like example, I do GCSE art, so I use it a lot for inspirations and for the parts and bits of work I have to do for my GCSE art.
And what sort of art do you create?
I do a lot of anime as well as a lot of like real life art.
Now, for someone my age, computers have just moved on leaps and bounds in my 50 something years that I've been around. But for you, you've kind of always grown up with computers, I guess.
Yeah.
So this doesn't seem weird to you?
Not really, no. Especially with my dad, who works a lot in technology. It's kind of one of those big parts of my life. So I use ChatGPT personally a lot, but I'm also known to use Character AI as well, which is like an app where you can talk to like characters from books and movies and that, which I think is really cool.
Right. So explain that, I've never even heard of that.
So Character AI is a website/app where you can choose the a character you want to talk to. So, for example, I watch an anime called My Hero Academia. I can look on the search bar for a specific character, and the chat will be exactly like that character. And you can.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, my dad banned me from using it because I use it too much. So.
Now, I would say it's because your dad doesn't understand AI, but you've just said he works in technology, so.
Yeah.
But all in all, what did you think of the exhibition? You enjoyed it?
Yeah, I think it's really information filled, and I really enjoyed knowing that it's not just for older generations, it's also targeted at my kind of age, like teenagers, so it's nice.
Not just for old duffers like me.
Moving along, I can see a glass showcase. There are photographs. There's some replica documents in there as well. Now, this looks a bit more traditional Bletchley Park Museum style. What am I looking at here?
So this showcase is looking at the connections that the field of artificial intelligence has with Bletchley Park. One side of the showcase, we are looking at the history of artificial intelligence connected with Bletchley Park. So during the war, Bletchley Park was a hub of technological innovation, and three of the codebreakers who worked here then went on to become early pioneers of the field of artificial intelligence. So we're looking here at Alan Turing, Donald Mickey, and Jack Good. So this side of the showcase is looking at their work and their contributions to that field. And then as you move round the showcase on the other side, we're looking at the more recent connections to artificial intelligence with the AI Safety Summit, which happened here in 2023, and the Bletchley Declaration that came from that.
Strangely that it's 2023, a historical occurrence, but a really key moment in not just AI safety and AI discussions, but we also think recent Bletchley Park history as well, bringing world leaders to Bletchley Park to discuss AI and its regulation and its safety.
So from the AI Safety Summit, the Bletchley Declaration came and it was signed by representatives from 28 different countries. We've got in the showcase an extract from that, and then we also have a copy of the declaration, which you can read through as well.
And just in summary, what is it that the Bletchley Declaration covers?
So the Bletchley Declaration looked at the need for global cooperation and regulation in order to continue the development of artificial intelligence in a safe and sustainable way.
It also pointed out that AI is with us right now. And I wanted to move over to the part of the exhibition that looks at AI through history and also in the present day. So moving to the middle of the gallery, this is a really striking structure that we've got in front of us.
In the centre of the gallery, we have a kind of cascading timeline of artificial intelligence development. So this structure kind of has three parts to it, which get wider and have more information of them as they go down towards the floor. And each row of this timeline represents a different era of AI development. So we have the very first thing on our timeline as 1935, the invention of radar, which was the idea that machines could potentially talk to each other. And that started a lot of thinking about artificial intelligence. And then as you go down the timeline, there's a row for the 50s, for the 60s and 70s, and then more recent as well, right up until events which are happening in 2024. And we've also left space so that we can add key milestones that happen over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's quite contentious as to why we've started at that date as well. I can understand we'll keep adding, but it must have been a bit of discussion as to really what was that first date you put on there.
There was a lot of discussion with our experts who we talked to about the history of computing and the history of artificial intelligence itself. Obviously, the history of computing goes back a very long way, and there are so many things that we could have included mm-hmm. in this timeline. Mm-hmm. But that felt like a really key point that started ideas about artificial intelligence specifically. So we tried to include just the key things.
And I'm looking at things on the timeline here. I can see a reference to the Turing test. I can see Shaky, the first mobile robot in 1966, and a photograph of that. There's a Furby photograph as well on there from the 90s. So some of this I think is going to be familiar, but I think a lot of this might be new to visitors as well, who maybe aren't familiar with the work in the 1960s and 70s and 80s on AI.
Yeah, I think often artificial intelligence is thought of as a really modern concept and technology, but the roots of it really do start back in the 50s when that first definition was made, and building blocks even before that in the 30s and 40s. So we've tried to pick out some key moments. Hopefully there's some stuff that people will recognise as they go around, but also some new information which will get people interested in the history and how it's come to be.
And what I love about this timeline is it connects from there right through to these four interactive screens that I can see kind of stemming from the bottom of this waterfall style display. And they're these beautiful digital screens encased in this gold, copperish coloured metal. And I'm drawn towards them. I want to touch these touch screens. Can you explain what's on those?
So these touch screens look at AI in our everyday life. So as we were creating the timeline, it became very obvious that AI is part of our everyday life, often in ways that we don't necessarily realise or think about that much. So we wanted to connect the history of AI to what it is right now. And when you look at these touchscreens, there are different icons on here which represent different parts of our everyday life. So we've got one for social media, for streaming, for smart alarms, and there are 8 overall on there. When you click on one of those icons, it comes up with a bit of information about how artificial intelligence is part of that thing. And then you can find out more as well, so you can get some more technical information there too.
Also next to these, I'm noticing we have large panels with braille and printed pictures that have sort of raised up off the metal base. Is accessibility something that you really foregrounded in the exhibition?
Definitely, we wanted to make this exhibition really accessible. Initially, when we were coming up with ideas for the exhibition, it was very visual, but we wanted to make sure that everyone could enjoy it. So around this timeline, we have 4 key points, which we've illustrated with these tactile images, so you can feel them. We worked with the RNIB on these, and they also have braille descriptions as well, so you can understand what you're feeling. We also incorporated British Sign Language into all the videos, and audio description will be coming to the gallery soon as well.
Mm-hmm. I can see subtitles, and there's going to be large text guides as well, I think. But having a temporary exhibition like this has really given us that opportunity to put as much in as we possibly can. Mm. That's fantastic.
Hi, my name is Stephen Lane. I'm a cybersecurity expert. I do quite a lot in defending critical national infrastructure from cyber threats. And naturally, I use artificial intelligence as part of the job that I do.
And I believe you ban your daughter from using certain AI tools.
Yeah, so I have encouraged her actually to use ChatGPT, which I think has got the right sort of ethical framework built into it, for her to be able to learn how AI will be important for her in the future. But there is at the moment an app out there called Character AI. And I think one of the challenges is that Character AI has hit the headlines for all the wrong reasons, because unfortunately it recently suggested to a teenager who was using it that they should kill their parents because of the fact that he had introduced limits on the amount of time that he could use on a phone. And sadly as well, very sadly, there are a couple of teenage suicides attributed to content that has been reported to be as part of Character AI. So the thing is AI is clearly a positive for society. It's got lots of very good things about it. Quite simply, it also has to have some guardrails in place, yeah. And there has to be some ethics around it too.
And you working in that industry, you can see that. Now, what do you think of the exhibition? Does the exhibition give you the right balance of the good and the bad?
Yeah, so I think the exhibition is very good, because I think what it shows you is very clearly some of the positives that AI is going to do for us. I mean, you know, the ability, for example, for AI to spot cancer in a scan much faster than a human being has got to be a positive for our society. I think, being a bit of a geek, I quite like the sort of AI in films and some of the dystopian stuff like The Matrix and all that, because that's what I'm like. And I think also as well, the other side of it that is represented in this exhibition is some of the challenges in cybersecurity and cyber warfare, and talking about malware, and talking about voice cloning with Rachel Toback as well on there. And, you know, that's very key, I think. But what we don't need to do is we don't need to be scaremongering. We definitely have to have that balance about the good and the potential risks of it.
I'm sure it can be quite easy to get carried away with examples of how AI can be quite frightening or how it's developing or might develop in the future. But I've noticed there's quite a balanced view in here. There's a few sections where you're talking about both the positive aspects of AI, but also the negative impacts of AI. Can you give us a bit of background on how you've done that in the exhibition?
So one of our real key aims with this exhibition was to show both the opportunities and the risks that comes with artificial intelligence. And we wanted to display some different case studies which explore both of those things so that our visitors can get a balanced view and then go away and make up their own mind about what they're excited about, what they're possibly scared about as well. Mm-hmm. So some examples of that, we have a section on environmental sciences and how AI is being used in that. We have four case studies which are shown in a projection, and that looks at some of the positive ways in which artificial intelligence has been used in environmental sciences. So it looks at flood warning systems, mm-hmm. it looks at how AI is being used to tackle climate change and improve farming systems as well. But then we also look at the negative impact of artificial intelligence on the environment. So the huge energy usage of data centers and of creating artificial intelligence as well.
Yep, the electricity required, the cooling power required to manage those. And yes, that's certainly something that's been in the news recently. I'm sure will continue to be in the news about reducing that impact. Mm. I think it's really important for us to show this here as well, that something as powerful, as game-changing as AI isn't just positive or isn't just frightening. I think it will always have both of those aspects to it. And it's been an important thing, I know, speaking with you as we've developed the exhibition, about how can we quickly, easily show those, but without cheerleading too loudly for AI or maybe shouting too cautionary a voice on how frightening it can be. There's a section on health and medicine I can see as well. And I think you've done the same there as well. Examples of how it can be used positively, but how AI also is something that we have to be careful of when we're talking about medical care.
Yes, so in our section on health and medicine, we found that a lot of people are really positive about the development that's happening there with artificial intelligence and feel like it can have a really positive impact and increase the speed of finding new drugs and be used in some really interesting ways. One of the examples we have here is about 3D printing organs. And we have actually a couple of replica organs lent from guys in St. Thomas's Hospital. And the doctors at those hospitals were telling us about how they're using artificial intelligence to improve the 3D printing process. But we also look at this section at data bias that can be found in artificial intelligence sets. So looking at how we need to create representative training sets so that the outcomes of artificial intelligence when it's analyzing huge sections of data will also be representative and won't have bias in it. So again, looking at both those positive and negatives.
Mm. And we have video on that subject where we hear Dr. Joy Bwelamwini talking about that, and it's absolutely fantastic. It's, for me, it's a real high point of the exhibition, exploring that bias that might sit invisibly right at the bottom of all those data sets that we rely so heavily on.
This is a quote from Dr. Joy Bwelamwini in her book, Unmasking AI. When machine learning is used to diagnose medical conditions, to inform hiring decisions, or even to detect hate speech, we must keep in mind that the past dwells in our data.
My name is Chris Baker. I'm a science director at Rothamsted Research. I'm the director of Intelligent Data Ecosystems. And we have a staff of about 55 data scientists working on a whole range of AI technologies, including the development of digital twins for farming, whole-scale farming. Our focus is on generating simulations of the farming systems. We want to know which crops will be viable in specific locations when the climate changes.
I mean, what did you think of it?
I think it touches on the breadth of AI. I can see areas where there are gaps. Explainable AI is not here.
Oh, right.
Trustworthy AI. What are these themes and concepts? Because the creative AI is fantastic, but there's no rigor around it having to be accurate.
Right.
Right? Whereas with drug discovery and diagnosis, you want to be damn sure that they're accurate. Mm. And so I think there's a clear distinction between those. Also with farming, climate change prediction and stuff, an area I work in. Yeah, we care a lot about the quality of the simulations. We talk a lot about uncertainty and the challenges of leveraging the capabilities of AI are bounded by the confidence we have in that prediction. We don't really spend a lot of time talking about the level of confidence we have in a prediction. Right? The error bars could be absolutely huge. We just talk about the capabilities of the of what we're trying to do. And this is very much about the art of the possible. There's a word that is used a lot these days called digital twin. It's almost like a subtopic within AI. And that, in essence, which I think is where we're going to see the next impact, because those you have much more contextual information about a scenario in which you then make forecasts within that context. So digital twins, I think, is a key piece I would include here. So I don't know what you think of my comments, but I would bring my daughter here. She'd love it. Everybody would enjoy it. I think it would be, it's a fantastic attraction and it goes way beyond anything you'll see in the Science Museum in London. So I give it a thumbs up. But I would say there's a few more things only because I'm...
You work in the field.
Yeah.
A couple of times you've mentioned target audiences, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about who are the target audiences for this exhibition, The Age of AI.
So we identified for this temporary exhibition a target audience of teenagers and people their parents' age. Obviously, we want this exhibition to have something for everyone who visits Bletchley Park, and hopefully by covering a broad range of topics, there'll be something interesting for every person who comes into this gallery. But we wanted to focus on that particular group and really try and get a conversation started with people who will be growing up with this technology and probably going to work in this technology as well.
And also with people who grew up with the internet when they were younger, teenagers or children. I say this as someone in their mid-40s, so kind of hopefully part of that other target audience age as well. I'm guessing though that this area that we're stood in front of will be a real conversation starter. What is this?
This section we're looking at is called Dreaming the Future. We're looking at a big navy blue section on the wall. And in the center of that, we've got this pulsing image of HAL's eye from 2001, A Space Odyssey. We also have lots of images on here from different TV shows, different books that look at artificial intelligence. And we also have a case here with a Cyberman helmet in. We've got a replica of the Terminator head and a little Wally toy as well.
So cute. It must have been really hard to make the selection of these posters, of these films, of these books. What was it that drove this particular selection, these particular groupings?
So we were really looking at, with this, what our target audience would be interested in. So we've got a real variety of different examples of AI from popular culture. We have quite a mix that we hope will encourage that conversation. So we've got The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, we've got The Matrix, and then we also have some more recent ones which hopefully our younger audience will recognise. So we've got Big Hero 6 here as well. And we wanted to look in this section at our relationship with AI and how we can examine that through popular culture. So some of the fears, you know, Space Odyssey and The Terminator, very much looking at the idea that AI might take over the world. Mm. But then some other ones like Wall-E and Big Hero 6, AI being a really friendly character in that and being used for positive use. So trying to look at some of those different relationships that we have and how that's changing.
I'm really looking forward to, over the next couple of years, seeing groups of younger people, adults stood in front of this and somebody saying, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. And the young people looking at them like they've gone mad. And hopefully that will prompt a conversation right in front of this piece with that big red glowing eye, it looks like, right in the middle of it.
Yeah, and the 2001 A Space Odyssey was particularly important for us to pick up on because one of the code breakers who worked here at Bletchley Park, Jack Good, actually was an advisor on that film and advised on the character of Hal. So we really wanted to pick up on that here.
Popular culture and films and TV aren't the only topic, though, that you found was particularly interesting to our target audiences. Social media was also an area where teenagers, obviously very, very familiar with it, and an area perhaps that their parents or that adults the age of their parents might be maybe less comfortable with?
Yeah, so we wanted to explore this topic, and it was something in our focus groups which there was loads of discussion on, trying to understand how artificial intelligence is increasingly being used in social media and the implications of that as well. One of the things we found when we were talking to teenagers and their parents in these focus groups was that teenagers quite often get their news also from social media as well. So there was another element to that in the way that we consume different news articles and information in a very different way. So trying to understand that a bit more and bring that into the exhibition.
And you've mentioned AI influencers, not just influencers about AI, but influencers who are AI. Is that a thing?
Yes, absolutely.
That's so
So there are influencers on social media who are AI characters, essentially, but they have their own social media accounts and they post on there and they promote different things and products, but they are generated by AI. So it's quite different and a new thing for me as well.
Oh, I think this part, and I know this from having spoken to you, this part might be your favourite bit of the exhibition.
I think it is, yes. This part that we're coming up to here, we are looking at a projection on a wall which has lots of different images kind of scrolling up, looking a little bit like social media. And what happens is it picks out one of those images and makes it really big, and it asks you to vote on whether you think it is a real life image or an AI generated image. Mm-hmm. And then we have a barrier here with lots of buttons on, and three people or groups of people can vote on that and find out the answer.
And it's been fooling a lot of people.
It has. We've had some people in testing it, and pretty much everyone has got fooled by quite a few in here, actually. Mm.
It's interesting because it can be taken as kind of quite scary that deepfakes can be quite so convincing. But also, I think those people that are now looking more closely at these images are going, oh, now I understand why I can see it's a deepfake. Is that the main purpose for this, to help people understand that?
Yeah, it's a really kind of fun and engaging piece, but there is that deeper message of understanding if you think you can trust a source, essentially. And some of these deepfake videos and images that we have are really good, and there's not necessarily the telltale signs of a slightly strange hand or an extra face in the background or something odd. A lot of the time it is about understanding your sources and looking into that. And thinking, when you look on social media or any news outlet, do I trust where this image has come from? So we're really trying to prompt that conversation.
And I imagine this is an area we'll have to be updating more and more as well, because of the next couple of years of the exhibition, this is going to become ever more sophisticated.
It's a technology that we've already seen develop a lot over just the last few months. So I'm sure we'll be updating it to make sure that we're keeping in with the times.
I think it's a very good exhibition. I really like it. Easily understood and presenting pros and cons in a believable way.
Brilliant.
And it was funny too.
Good.
The voice recognition thing and the sort of guess if it's life or fake was very good too. I really liked it, and I don't think that you or I produced in any way. And I like you too. I am Ingmarie Osterlund, and I am Swedish, and I'm married to Simon, who is English and who is a cybersecurity expert.
Retired, but it's a fascinating exhibition. Lots of interesting threads around it. There's one which said an AI model was rejected because it would produce hallucinations. So come up with plausible sounding things which were completely false. It's just scary that those things that 50 years ago were rejected as being completely bizarre and unreasonable are now being accepted, and they're there in real life. It's worrying how that's going.
But all in all, you think it's a good exhibition?
Exhibition is,
yes,
excellent.
It's necessary, and a lot of younger people should come and see it, definitely.
And I think it's very good targeted at your target audience of teenagers and youngsters. They need to understand that the critical thinking that you need to be doing to be able to spot the fakes and how you go and look at fakes and what source of data. And
and it is accessible.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you're our best advert yet.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well done.
So we've said we aren't AI experts, but we spoke to AI experts, and I know you certainly did, and Steve, our content curator, certainly did as well. In this section that we're standing at about crime and safety, you spoke to the National Crime Agency, to the National Cybersecurity Centre. Can you tell me a bit more about what that relationship was like speaking with the subject matter experts and how they helped shape what you've chosen to talk about in the gallery?
I'd say throughout the exhibition and development process, all of the subject matter experts who we've talked to have been super helpful. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, I'm certainly not an expert in computing or AI. And they've been very generous with their time, helping us to understand these really important matters and how we can make that accessible for a public audience like me, who don't necessarily know loads about the technology. So for this section on crime and safety, we again were looking at both the positives and negatives. So how AI can be used in a malicious way to spread crime, but also how certain agencies are using it in order to detect and prevent crime. Mm. So we worked with the National Crime Agency and the National Cybersecurity Centre, as well as the AI Safety Institute, in order to understand how they're using it and how people can protect themselves online when it comes to AI crime. So one of the examples we look at in this section is about how AI could potentially be used to clone your voice. So we have a video with Rachel Toback, who's an ethical hacker, where she demonstrates how she has done this. Mm. And then we also have an interactive display where you can actually try cloning your voice yourself and hearing it back.
It's uncanny, I would say. I've had a go at this and it does sound like me speaking at me. I hate the sound of my own voice, but it's so fascinating. I think this is one of those areas where I've noticed people using it do think that's quite frightening, but I think it's a way that we can help people understand how to educate themselves, that this is out there and it might be being used for language learning, but it might be being used for nefarious purposes. So it is important, I think, as you said, to create that balance.
One of the challenges in putting this exhibition together was creating that balanced story and selecting the right examples out of so many different ways in which AI is being used at the moment. So one of the things that our content curator Steve did was talk to lots of experts in order to make sure we were choosing the right things and really giving that balanced perspective.
My name's Stephen Swaby. I'm a writer and I was content curator for this exhibition at Bletchley Park.
Steve, you researched and developed the content for this exhibition, The Age of AI. Can you tell me a little bit about coming up with the themes when you first started and how you chose those?
Yes, I think, you know, our starting point was looking at the provisional work that you'd done here in-house, thinking about the size of the gallery as well and also your audience. They were the really important starting points. Who is it for? And I think from then we started thinking about, well, how does AI manifest itself in daily life? Which are the big topics? Which are the big areas where we can see it already visible? And it was then beginning to assemble a long list of the various topics we could explore in more detail.
When we started looking at this exhibition, we identified that we wanted to talk about opportunities and risks and regulation within AI and how it's being developed. We talked about how to make that interesting for our audience. Our target audience was teenagers and people their parents' age. And we did a few focus groups as well. Can you tell us a bit about some of the interesting parts which came out of that?
I think it was a great exercise to do that because it challenged some assumptions. And there were certain topics that we thought initially might be interesting that didn't fly very well at all in that focus group, and other things they really latched onto. So it was a bit of a recalibration of what we should focus on and a really good signpost for what were going to be the hot topics that were really appealing. And I think, you know, the bottom line was always asking, well, what's it got to do with me? Why should I care about AI? And then that leads us into, you know, highlighting the main areas, the main themes that we were going to focus in on.
You mentioned that there were some themes that we thought about which didn't go down so well, then other things which our focus group really latched onto. Can you tell us a bit more about those?
The minefield of dating and dating apps was something that went down like a lead balloon, particularly with focus group parents as well. So that was something we realised it would probably be not wise to pursue. It was too controversial. We looked to, again, explore around other aspects of social media instead and focusing on those. And another area that we decided quite early on didn't feel quite right for the tone and the content of the exhibition was also looking at defence and the military uses of AI as well, which doesn't really have that much to do with the average teenager. So that was something else that we decided wasn't worth covering.
We've talked a bit about how we wanted to make this exhibition really relevant to our audience, making sure that those themes are things that they can connect to in their everyday life. But you also worked a lot with experts in the field to understand artificial intelligence, how it's being developed, and make sure that we can translate that and accurately give that information to our audience. Can you tell me a bit about working with them and how you selected those stories to go into the exhibition?
Definitely speaking to the experts was the next really important part of the research. And I was very fortunate that Bletchley Park's got a great contact book. And we also reached out to a broad spectrum of additional people in many different fields across the industry. People that are developing AI, people that are working with the deployment of AI, and people that are almost philosophers of AI. So there was a great range of people to chat to. And we had a very intense period over the summer where we had lots of meetings, lots of conversations. And you begin to draw in a number of different views and opinions, some incredibly positive, somebody partisan, and some perhaps a little bit more wary and negative about where AI is right now and where it's going. So I think you and I then sat down, you know, with all these conversations in mind, assembled this menu of ideas, and that helped set the direction of what the key messages were going to be for each of the themes that we were going to be exploring in the gallery.
Something that's been really important while putting this exhibition together has been giving that balanced view of the positives and the negatives, the opportunities and the risks that come with AI. And you mentioned that a lot of experts have different opinions on what they think the future of AI will look like and that role in everyday life. Can you tell us some examples of where those came out and how you managed to keep a balanced view of that throughout the gallery?
Definitely. Particularly when you speak to scientists and medical professionals, there's a lot of positivity about what AI is currently doing for them and how it's transforming their work. So you hear nothing but good things from a lot of scientists about what AI is and what it represents. I think for other people, particularly speaking to people like the Ada Lovelace Institute, there's the whole thing about ethics and the fact that we need to balance and check AI as it's being developed. And it needs to be done with society's participation, not to society. So there's a huge challenge there getting that across. And I think we had to sit down and make sure that what we were writing in that first draft script came across as balanced and neutral. And it represents the exhibition as this starting point and a launch pad for people to go into the topics and then begin to dig deeper if they're really interested in different facets of where they meet AI in their daily lives.
One of the last parts of the exhibition, and I think somewhere where that really shines through, is when we have our exhibition video where we talk to three experts about their opinions on AI. Something that was really important for us was not just having one person, but having multiple opinions there.
Yeah, we had some amazing minds in the room, didn't we? It was fantastic to get people of that quality to talk to us. And I think we did start out with a long list of questions, and then we sort of winnowed it down to about five or six, bearing in mind that this was going to be a short form video that's in the gallery. I think it's like a 2-3 minute running time, isn't it? So we had to be, you know, really judicious about what we chose as the questions to ask on the day. We could have had very, very lengthy conversations with them about any of those particular things, but I think it was capturing their individual views on and their perspectives on where they sit within the industry and the development of AI, you know, academically and also on the front line in technological development. It was capturing their individual perspectives and how they see things emerging now and in the near future, where's it going to go next? And obviously your speculation's rife about that, and nobody knows for sure where AI is going next, but people have some pretty good ideas of the kind of the direction of travel in certain facets of the industry.
Another thing you mentioned there was the size of the gallery and the amount of time people will stay in it. The gallery is one room, one single room, and we cover so many different topics there and have chosen a lot of different stories to bring out this conversation around artificial intelligence. How much of a challenge was it for you when you started looking at the topic of AI, which is so broad and there are news articles coming out all the time about this, to narrow down what we decided to look at in the end?
It was partly thinking visually as well, wasn't it? It was, you know, what would look interesting or attractive in this gallery? What would capture people's attention and capture the eye? and make them think, actually, I want to spend 2 minutes or 3 minutes finding out more about this particular one. And I think it really helped introduce things like pop culture, which has many different facets, and it's quite attractive to put something like that in the gallery. So it was creating a visually interesting range as well, and making sure it wasn't too dry or the language was too complex. You know, it's hopefully very approachable and very accessible for the average visitor to come in and spend half an hour, 45 minutes exploring and cherry picking really what interests them, you know, what we've got on offer within the space.
Something that we talked about a lot when we were creating this exhibition was wanting people to come in and, as you said, cherry pick, see what interests them, be attracted to that, find out a little bit, but then leave and want to find out more as well. How do you go about doing that and introducing people to a really complex subject in an accessible way and make them leave wanting to find out more?
It's trying to make it as engaging as possible, isn't it? And for that short period of time, it's got to be quite punchy and capture people's imaginations and pique their interest. Then if you're really interested, you can then, you know, there's resources being provided by Bletchley Park. There's multiple books and websites and content everywhere that you can start digging deeper and exploring the different themes to what level you choose. But I was very conscious of not becoming too overbearing with too many layers of information and you know, sending people into a coma by providing detailed technical information, which I don't understand either. So it was really just trying to give people the headlines and just give that kind of 360 view of, yeah, AI is with us every day and in pretty much everything we do from the moment we wake up to when we go to bed. It's there somewhere in our digital interactions.
And neither of us are experts in artificial intelligence at all. We both work in museums. How did you find talking to experts in this subject and digesting all that information yourself? How was that journey for you?
Well, it was very important for me to let them know that I was an idiot and they were dealing with an idiot, and therefore they could explain in very simple terms their incredibly complex jobs. So that was a good starting point. And I asked those questions as a, you know, an interested member of the public, really, that's uninformed about a lot of AI. And that was part of the learning process, because they would recommend books or certain websites or different areas to explore and give you the benefit of their own knowledge and their own experience as well. So that there was this, you know, tsunami of information that came at me over the summer, but it really helped me get up to speed very fast on topics that I had quite vague notions about when we started the journey together on this.
And finally, is there something in the Age of AI exhibition which you are most proud of?
I think it was the delight in discovering the connection between Bletchley's pioneers and one of my favourite subjects, which is sci-fi, and discovering that Jack Good was an advisor on 2001 working with Stanley Kubrick, and having a chance to visit the Kubrick archives and explore the paperwork between them back in the mid-60s when, you know, Good was consulted as one of the experts that developed the ideas of AI that you see manifested in what is an absolutely classic benchmark sci-fi film. So being able to uncover some of those original conversations and put a little bit of that in the gallery was a really unexpected treat, you know, and a nice little filigree detail that we were able to add during the process.
An area in the news about AI that is everywhere, it seems, right now, and I don't imagine is going to go away, is how AI is being used or could be used in the creative industries, in music and in art and in films. And there's a section of the exhibition where we look at that. And some of these stories are really fascinating. Can you give us a bit more background about some of these?
So this was one of the areas which, when we were talking to our focus group at the very beginning of developing the exhibition, looking at what topics might interest them, creative industries came out really strongly. They were really interested in how it was being used in gaming, in film, in making music. And so we wanted to pick up on that. What we're looking at here is a kind of grid of 8 different examples of creative industries where AI is developing and being used. So we've got a screen here which shows a couple of clips from the first AI-generated film, The Frost. We've also got an example of an artist who has used AI in her work, so she uses it to train robots, then paints with it.
You also mentioned the artist Ada, who is a robot AI artist who created that picture of Alan Turing that went up to auction recently.
Yes, indeed. So we mentioned her as well. We've got an example of an album that has been created using AI music. So we're looking at some of the ways in which creatives are using AI as a tool to help enhance their art. Mm-hmm. We also asked the question about IP. So who owns this? How is it going to affect the job market in creative industries as well? Could this be a negative thing or could it be a positive thing? So once again, bringing that conversation of a balanced view so that people can think more about what it means to them.
And I think this will be another really thought-provoking conversation starting bit of the exhibition, because you can see the real benefits of it. Using AI as a tool, and the possibilities are endless, but there must be plenty of people out there who feel threatened or really concerned about how AI might take over the industry in ways that they just simply can't control. We also hear from experts talking about the job market and how AI might influence the future over in the last bit of the exhibition.
We've got to balance off the pros, so the kinds of things that we can do to help the environment, discover new materials, be better at climate forecasting, do better messaging towards people so that they engage in better environmental activities, against the fundamental cost of running these AI systems, which is something that we don't necessarily talk about as much. We want this kind of technology to be a rising tide that lifts all boats, not just those people that have been fortunate enough to have interactions with it or be able to afford to have interactions with it.
That was Dr. Ed Pizer-Knapp, Chief Scientific Officer at Zyme. Can you tell us about the three experts that we're seeing here and what sort of things are they saying?
So the last section of the exhibition, we have a video where we interviewed three experts, so Dame Wendy Hall, Dr. Edward Pizer-Knapp, and Professor David Leslie. And we wanted to have a range of different opinions about the future of AI. And we asked them about what they thought AI might look like in 10 years' time, how it might develop. Mm-hmm. We asked them how they think it might affect the job market, and also what they thought the biggest opportunities and the biggest risks of AI will be. So it's really interesting to find out their thoughts on that and bring it to our audience to have a think about and take that away with them.
The kind of scaling of AI, which has really defined a lot of the breakthroughs of the past few years, that is really hitting a bit of a plateau at the moment. So I think as we move to the next 5-10 years, we're going to need more innovation when it comes to thinking about innovative techniques to increase the kind of reasoning capabilities of the systems. I think AI is already transforming labor markets. These technologies will cut across all sectors. We won't see, I don't think, replacement of some of the fundamental social endeavors that characterize our kind of labor environment.
That was Professor David Leslie, the Director of Ethics at the Alan Turing Institute. Inevitably, it's incredibly hard to fit all of the things we've wanted to fit here, even in a 2-3 minute film like that in the gallery. Just how have you been able to do that? And particularly with these experts, how have you been able to whittle down these opinions, these different answers to these really big questions into such a short period of time?
It was definitely a challenge. We had such interesting conversations with these three people, and we could have talked on and on with them about all of the developments in artificial intelligence. But we wanted to give a snapshot of that for our audience so that in the gallery they can enjoy it and find out a little bit more, and hopefully they'll want to leave and do some more research and find out more. So we're actually uploading the full-length interviews to our website as well, so that you can have a look and listen to the rest of that, as well as a page of different resources if you're interested in doing a bit more research and finding out how AI is developing at the moment.
This is Dame Wendy Hall. She is the Regius Professor of Computer Science at the University of Southampton.
There will, of course, be short-term losers as AI increasingly automates the workplace. But there will be a vast number of jobs created by AI that should enable us to be more creative as well And I see it as team play. It's us working with the AI to do things better, faster, more efficiently, more cheaply. AI's capabilities are already quite profound and they're going to get more so. They're changing the way we do science. They're changing the way we work. They're going to change the way we live our lives. In the long term, we have to make sure we keep control of it rather than letting it control us.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.